Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Occult Disney. In this series, we break down all of the feature-length Disney animations, the original stories they were based on, how and why they differ, rumored hidden subliminal messages, and occult symbolism. If you love this content from Paranoid American, don't forget to rate us on your podcast platform. Want to go even deeper? Join the Paranoid American Patreon for early access to episodes, exclusive videos, sneak peeks of upcoming comics, and free sticker packs. Don't miss out on this all-access pass to the mysteries and magic behind the scenes. Visit ParanoidAmerican.com and help support a veteran-owned independent publisher creating original content and comics. Do it today. That's ParanoidAmerican.com.
There we go. Okay. So, yeah. I do like... It is nice getting through the short ones. I'm about to watch RoboCop for the fourth time in a year.
Really? I don't think I've ever watched that one more than once in a year.
It's been our, for the sci-fi one, it's like our cursed podcast where we keep having last minute guest withdrawals. So we'll see if it really happens or not this week, but I guess I'll watch it again. It's not the worst movie to watch more than once, so.
It's not horrible. I actually found a couple of Schwarzenegger movies that I realized I had never seen before that I just put on my list.
Which ones are those? Weekend.
Let's see here. I think one's called Red Heat.
Oh, yeah, that's fun. That's where he's Russian, I believe.
And I don't remember what the other one is. It had James Belushi in it, I believe. Unless that's also Red Heat.
I think that's Red Heat, yeah. But there's lots of weird, obscure ones. Not obscure, but like Eraser with the weird CGI crocodiles. That's kind of fun.
I like the Eraser. I think I've seen all of them that were like 90s and after.
Okay. What is the first one he did? I think it might even be like before. Well, not the first one because he, you know, was in those movies in the 70s. But there's one that I definitely was not on my radar because I didn't know what to do with him. He wasn't like famous enough that he had his persona in place yet. So it's a really odd view. And I am bringing up his filmography. My computer's being creaky though because Zoom's open.
Raw Deal was the other one that I hadn't seen before.
Okay. Maybe Red Heat doesn't have Belushi, or maybe they both do.
No, it's Red Heat's the one with Belushi. And then Raw Deal came like 4 years before that.
That's the one I was thinking of. Raw Deal's the one where they like don't like let him Schwarzenegger. I don't know what the verb is, but something like that. But yeah, it's just kind of a weird disconnect of a film because it's like it doesn't have, it's not like he's doing a bad job. It's just they didn't make any room for him to be charming in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, he still got top billing and it came after Commando, although they're probably making it before Commando like exploded, I assume.
Yeah. I guess we'll change gears. So as I have my normal, got to go to work eventually thing. So give it just a quick couple seconds of silence and I'll intro us in. Hello, welcome to Oral Hygiene. We are continuing our dive into Occult Disney with number 3. It's Pinocchio today. This is Matt here. Joining again is Thomas Gorens, the Paranoid American. Hello.
Hello, hello.
You said you were pretty excited for this one.
Yeah, just because I think this is probably the movie that I saw the most growing up. So I'm like way more attached to this one. This one and Dumbo, I think were on repeat the most out of all the Disney movies that were in our library. So this one just, and rewatching it here, a lot of it is like the earbugs. I'm realizing that there's like certain weird tics that I do where I hear like rhythms and patterns in things that aren't there, and I can almost trace it back to this scene with Geppetto and his clocks, and like they're all going off these different times with like weird noises. So for whatever reason, this one is buried deep down inside my brain somehow.
I guess he didn't have the clock synced up as well as Doc Brown, but it was like, what, 150 years earlier. So we'll give him a pass on that. But yeah, you know, Disney's still like a giant thing in Japan. So I often get the, what's your favorite Disney character, usually character, not movie, from the kids. Now I usually go with Dumbo with the explanation that because he can't talk. So I don't know.
Dumbo's a sad one, a real sad one.
And a real weird one. But yeah, I guess one, this is the first one where I'm just like, yes, this, I straight up enjoy watching Pinocchio, because Snow White, I'm mostly appreciating the animation, as I said, the movie itself. Very good. Obviously, it's a classic, but I can't just like kind of sit back with it. Fantasia, you have to like actively watch. So you can't really just chill with that. But Pinocchio flows very nicely.
It's a great story. I mean, it's fun to watch. The animation's great. And the pacing, I think, is way better than anything that you would get in the previous Disney movies here. It moves along, you know, quite rapidly.
Yeah, I did notice it takes quite a while to get out of Geppetto's workshop, but after that point, it just keeps like, you know, if you don't like what's on the screen, wait 2 minutes, right?
It's like the most important part, though, right? It's like the watching the Miracle of Life replayed. So, you know, but it's like, I think it's like the first half hour or something. It's not terribly long.
No, another time I was like, oh, a modern movie probably wouldn't pace it this way. So,
yeah, they kick him out and have him on the road within like 15 minutes, probably.
I'm going to call back on your PR skills, I guess, to give the TV Guide rundown of Pinocchio just to refresh people's brains.
Okay. I mean, so Pinocchio, if we don't go to the historical, we just talk about the movie. It's essentially about a craftsman that creates a wooden puppet by the name of Pinocchio, and he just kind of wishes that it was a real boy. So one night, a magical fairy comes in, turns the puppet into a real boy, and the boy kind of gets sent out into the world to become, you know, a real boy, quote unquote, by kind of going through life's trials and tribulations and essentially coming through it morally, you know, intact. So like avoiding, you know, the typical like sloth and stealing and, you know, any sort of what you would probably say we're on like the 10 commands, essentially, any sort of like moral failings would result in him not becoming a real boy. So it's just kind of his whole entire story through, and we're going to get into the esoteric version of that, but that's sort of like the back of the, you know, book summary.
And I just of course, that summary could also be taken out and applied to AI. Like, I'm just sitting there thinking, hey, you didn't say
the movie AI?
Yeah. It's like, that's a plot summary for AI as well. So,
well, I mean, that was pretty much just a modern retelling.
Yeah, they got the blue fairy.
Of the Pinocchio story, yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, since you didn't use proper nouns, it's like, oh, you could like put that towards either movie without any changes.
and you probably know this, but for anyone that doesn't, I always found it interesting that AI was supposed to be a Stanley Kubrick movie, but he passed away before he was able to like fully, I guess, collaborate with it. It was going to be him and Steven Spielberg, and then Steven Spielberg kind of took the reins, and he claimed that he did what he thinks Kubrick kind of had in mind for it. That part's debatable, but it was just interesting that at one point that AI movie was going to be a collaboration between Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg, which is just a fascinating concept, even though it didn't pan fully out exactly that way.
I remember when that first came on DVD, we found this magic formula where I don't remember, there's a point in the movie where we'd start like playing Bjork's Vespertine over it, and it like maybe when he crashes into the water,
it magically synced up like Pink Floyd and the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that was intentional at all. It just worked really well. So, yeah, the Pink Floyd Wizard of Oz things absolutely does not work. I was student teaching about 20 years ago, and I remember because one of the guy decided that day, the teacher was just going to play Pink Floyd and Wizard of Oz for all of his classes. So I saw it like 6 times, does not sync up.
So you don't have to put it like on like 45 RPM or like some special, you know, algorithm on your, like some special RPM to get it to sync up.
No, it just, you got to smoke a lot of marijuana for it to sync up, to be honest.
Well, that always helps. Yeah.
Now one that does, not to go wildly off topic, but, Pink Floyd's Echoes, it's a 20 minute track. If you start that at the, Infinite and Beyond, card of 2001, that does sync up all the way to the end of the movie. So it makes a nice little alternate soundtrack, because there's no dialogue in that sequence anyway. So you can
I guess anything that you can find that's 20 minutes long will sync up to that.
yeah, but it ends exactly when the movie ends. You do wonder if they were in the studio actually kind of jamming along with that film when they did it or something. As we're, I guess we should plunge into Pinocchio a little bit then. This one's not grim. This one's kind of a different, gestation, I guess.
Right. And actually, that's a really good point, because it has it stand out in quite a few different ways. Being from sort of like a children's book author, but he was also on the side of political author. So it's got a lot of politics and references to things that were going on in Italy specifically at that time, that makes it really like an interesting cultural piece almost too, like a nice kind of like snapshot in history.
Yeah, it's kind of weird with the that seems to be like an Italian thing, because I remember when I read the Inferno, I read an annotated one, which actually, had, it was like half of it was Dante's Inferno and the other half was notes of who all these people are, which made the book far more interesting, of course.
Yeah, because he's talking about like popes of his time and like scandals that occurred around his time, that if you read it now without those cliff notes, you'd have to be like a serious history buff. But if you read it at the time, it was like, someone talking about scandalous things about like, Donald Trump or Joe Biden or something like that. You would kind of more or less know what they were talking about in that time period.
There's a fun thing there is I got through the Inferno, got through the Purgatorio, I started the Paradiso and got bored, because heaven's boring, I guess, if you're, you don't want that.
Just a bunch of white clouds. Everyone's playing the same song and the same instruments over and over.
Yeah. This story was late 19th century. And I'm not looking at the timeline. Wonder if this is when Italy was a thing or when Italy was still kind of a not really a country.
Italy was sort of split up politically, and they were in the middle of a lot of other turmoil that was going on in Europe at the time. And there was on a tangent that we can go down here in a short while here, but there's a few that were key players within Italy that were really important to kind of look back in the time period in which Pinocchio came out of. One of those is Giuseppe Mazzini, who was essentially like he's kind of been referred to as like the Italian Illuminati. He was with the Carbonari, which was a secret society that was essentially bent on just liberation and revolution, very similar to the French Revolution and the American Revolution kind of happened in like these secret lodges. Well, Mazzini, he had the same exact idea to use the Carbonari to do the same kind of thing throughout Italy. And there's a lot of crossover here between his writings and his beliefs and the original author of Pinocchio reading his writings and his beliefs, and some of those finding their ways into the story even.
I guess my question would be, how much of that actually makes its way into the movie? The other examples I'm thinking of is H.G. Wells' The Time Machine is like this kind of communist breakdown, right? Which doesn't really yes. completely make it to the 1960 film. And then The Wizard of Oz is almost like an economic dissertation, which definitely doesn't make it to the famous version of the film. So,
right. That one was like walking away from fiat, or no, walking away from the gold standard and into fiat currency. And the yellow, this is the one that I've heard, is that the Yellow Brick Road is saying like, follow the gold standard. don't go to this fiat currency. That's one of my favorite interpretations of that one.
Yeah, yeah. And gee, we even got Prince near the end of his career doing tunes like The Gold Standard. Interesting stuff. Crazy, amazing. Yes. And I am getting the date right with this story being from late 19th century newspaper. It was serialized, I believe.
Correct. It was sometime in actually the mid 1800s. So it was closer to the mid 19th century than the late 19th century. Although it was developed over a period of time in like short periodicals, almost like a Calvin and Hobbes style, not necessarily fully visual, but the way that it was periodic over many, many years. And then it got compiled into a single story, The Adventures of Pinocchio, that became, sort of this like manuscript that eventually turned into the movie over, half a century later.
And the character of Pinocchio, I didn't like reread it or anything for this, for better or for worse, but I do remember him being way more unlikable in the literary version. Like, he's kind of a nasty kid.
A little bit. I mean, again, he was supposed to show sort of like the morals and the tribulations of that particular point in time. And it wasn't necessarily as nice as the Americas in the 1940s when the Pinocchio movie came out. You know, this was being written about things that people were going through in like the 1850s or so. And it, I think the full book came out in like the 1880s, like 1883 or something, but it had been, you know, getting compiled over, you know, decades prior to that.
Yeah. Better in the Charles Dickens one where he's apparently paid by the word. I've heard that's like not true, but I can't read Charles Dickens, so I assume it is true.
I mean, it's a pretty standard practice.
Yeah.
Like even today, if you try to get, you know, like a ghostwriter or just like a technical writer, they'll charge you by the word essentially.
But
and yeah, that comes with a lots of extra verbose, sort of like over the top extra words everywhere because it gets you paid.
That's why I found that when I was, you know, doing all my proper reading in high school and university, I found myself gravitating, you know, modern English books were fine. But past that, I'd usually enjoyed translated works more because they were translated into more modern English, right? Where a 300-year-old book is in pretty creaky English.
Yeah, they're not really easy to read. I read one recently that was written in like the early 1800s, and they just had a style of using about 50 words where maybe five would do, but it was kind of like the norm of the time. And it's interesting because this book is a good example too, but it just takes better storytelling and better writing techniques. And then everyone that comes after that is like, oh, that's how you tell a story, or that's how you organize information. Oh yeah, of course, we've always known that. But it's like, if you go back 100 years, people didn't always know that. And you go back another 100, it's like, oh wow, they didn't even really understand how to break down information into like digestible sections. Only like the very best did. So anyways, and that's another good example of at least this Pinocchio story, is that it does have these very definitive sections and sort of events that, you know, have these very stark milestones that here ends one scene and begins the next. And that also exists in the previous original writings.
I wonder if part of the appeal for this one, just as from the creative perspective then, was how kind of modular it was. If you have a team of animators working on 1 5-minute segment, it's not working. It's not that hard to, you know, cancel that one and bring in another one. Or as Disney definitely does later on with TV and things, you know, take a segment out of this and just make it like a short cartoon.
Yeah, I actually wonder how much, if anything, was kind of left on the cutting room floor of these original animations, or was it that it was such an enormous amount of work that almost everything was salvaged and we see it all? There's not a lot of information out that I'm aware of. That would be cool if there was like some, you know, like secret cutting room floor scenes that no one's ever seen of like Pinocchio that got, you know, never made it to the movie. That would have been a lot of invested time and money just to go to nowhere, though.
Right. But they're breaking so much ground. Obviously, this wasn't cheap. So I could see money not necessarily being wasted, but maybe being used a little bit more experimentally. Something else I've heard that you might shine a little light on is that this is the A team of animators at Disney at the time, whereas the old men were relegated to the B team and making Dumbo.
Actually, yeah, that's a great point here. And you can also see in the title opening up here, there's two, I don't know if you noticed this, but when I think Jiminy Cricket's like on like a bookshelf and he's kind of walking through and giving this intro, you can see these books on the shelf behind him that also ended up getting the A-Team. One of them was Alice in Wonderland and the other one was Peter Pan. And this almost starts this long running tradition that you could maybe argue started with Fantasia, or, you know, Pinocchio and Fantasia coming out around the same time, but where they kind of plant these images that's a teaser of what's yet to come in, you know, the next movies. And, you know, people do that now. You trace like the reference to Cars and to Toy Story and, you know, Monsters, Inc. They all have like a little symbol that connects one movie to the next. So you can almost see that happening here. And I don't know if it's because they knew what teams were going to be on those movies, but those were also two of the other, you know, sort of huge blockbuster hits for them.
Yeah. You know, from the perspective now, it's kind of like, well, there's so many years in between, but it's like, well, those were the war years and the Disney animation was kind of moved on to other projects during that time. So the big time gap actually does make sense. kind of like how the, you know, in 2020, the media was based, or at least filmed media was pretty much not made for a year, right? So
yeah, everyone just kind of took a break to wait and see what would happen.
Except for all the quarantine films. Those are fun. Have you seen any of those? When we did Back to the Future too, I actually brought on the guy that ringleadered one of those, where it's just like everyone signed up for a scene, filmed it in or around their house. And
that's kind of cool. I mean, I saw a couple TV shows where people did it like remotely, and there was a couple movies that came out. The Bubble was one of them, where they all sort of like that's the premise. There was another really good one. I can't remember the name of it, but it was something where like these people were living in an apartment building. It was the girl from Orange is the New Black, and her and like someone that lives in her apartment building, they realize that there's this big pandemic going on, but I think it ends up being like zombie related, but it's it happened during the exact same time as like the pandemic started. So
looking at the town, maybe it's because I've like been to Germany and Austria. I guess this is a really kind of melded sort of culture coming through, because it's northern Italy, but it's got that super Bavarian feel as well.
Yeah, well, if you look into the history of some of the names of the actual characters, they have these kind of Tuscan variations, so that lines up exactly, that, you know, a lot of this is kind of like in that Tuscan northern Italy area.
But yeah, because from what I understand, I mean, I haven't been to Italy, but if you hit what Sicily, it really is not the same country. That's why Italy wasn't really a thing until about 130 years ago, or, well, 150, I guess, would be a better number. But
yeah, I think one of the examples there of like specifically the different parts of Italy that affected this time was the name Geppetto, I think, was like a diminutive of Geppo, which was a Tuscan version of Ceppo with a C instead of a G, which stood for like a log or like a fat piece of wood, essentially. And that was where the name Geppetto came from. So it was this evolution of like a very specific Tuscan variation of the word for wood, and then turned into a name by adding the Eto, you know, Geppetto.
Mm. Yeah, I was just reading a book basically about like how guitar woods are sourced, but having this as one of the major hotspots. And of course, they were talking about musical instruments, and you do see that one like kind of carved violin in Geppetto's toy workshop, or clock, whatever. I guess he's making a bit of a jack of all trades there. But
although he seems to be a clockmaker more than anything else. But yeah, he's got various toys and stuff, because I mean, I assume that if you're the one woodworker in town, you're kind of doing it all.
Although his
but it does seem that like making a clock would be very distinct from being a carpenter. But as we get into sort of like the esoteric meanings of this, that it makes more sense than just having some random guy be good at two completely different things.
Well, he wasn't good at making violins. That thing was unplayable.
The string, it might have been like, in there to repair. Who knows?
Maybe. I was just like, those strings are like way off of the fingerboard. So that's just not going to happen. But yeah, like I said, they spend 20 plus minutes in the workshop, but they're also creating life. So
there is the one of the best earworms in there, but it's not even a verbal. But it's when, like I mentioned, all the clocks start going on, and there's a couple particular scenes that I'll just never forget. One is there's a drunk that comes out of like his house, and there's a big bottle of liquor that's essentially like the bottom of the clock. And he comes out and he's got his own little bottle of liquor, and he's like vomiting as the alarm goes off. Like it's the sound of him either vomiting or hiccuping. I always thought that was hilarious. And then that ties directly into a lady like spanking her kid on her lap. And like the way that the kid yelps every time she spanks him, it's to like denote, you know, the second hand ticking. I don't know, for whatever reason, those two are so catchy. Like the actual noises they make are so damn catchy that the visuals are kind of like baked in my brain along with those noises. And when I was watching this movie again for the first time in, I don't know, like a few months at least, because I watched it, you know, recently. But this, I don't know, for some reason, I feel like I'm, you know, sitting Indian style in front of an old, you know, 1980s TV again, like 4 inches away when I hear this one.
Yeah, I actually, what I noticed is the mildly racist clock that was sitting Indian style.
There's a number of them. Yeah, there's a number of especially as you go into the next Disney movies. Well, I was going to say another kind of weird thing that I noticed in the toy shop early on is the sexualized fish Cleo that has like a almost like a voluptuous sort of build and these like lips, these big, you know, thick sort of like sexy lips. And she's got a thing for the cat apparently, because before bed, you know, Geppetto makes the cat kiss he kisses the fish and he kisses the cat and he says, okay, cat, now kiss the fish. And like, she's, you know, bashful and delighted to get this kiss from him. I always thought that was kind of weird. And yeah, there's like some sexual tension between the cat and the fish, it seems.
Maybe that's getting some Sylvester cat energy. I thought my take was the cat wanted to eat the fish, but.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. But the fish apparently is unaware of of this impending doom.
And then, yeah, that's that. We saw that fish basically in Fantasia. So there's a bit of that reused animation. Again, not a problem. I did think it was funny when the fish goes to sleep. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's not how fish sleep, but.
Yeah, puts like the little fins under her chin and kind of like rests her head like it's a pillow. Yeah, I love that, though. That's one of the coolest parts of these Disney animations is that anthropomorphizing of all kinds of like Beauty and the Beast is another great one. Like they made a candlestick and a clock look like, you know, cool little characters and stuff. I find it amazing to do that because it's a skill that I can't even envision that. But when you see like a Disney animator, it's like, oh yeah, of course the candlestick's a person. How can it not look like a person, you know?
Yeah, we get that later in what, Beauty and the Beast too, with the talking candlestick. I've actually never watched that movie, but what was I? Oh yeah, I did notice when Geppetto's wishing on the first star he sees, he must be pretty close to blind because there's about 50 stars out there.
I mean, I think he's specifically looking for Polaris, but they don't say it by name.
Is Polaris her wishing star? I feel like I usually end up noticing Venus, which of course not being a star, but
maybe. But if we get into sort of like the occult and Gnostic interpretations of this, it would almost certainly be Polaris, which is the North Star, which is kind of like Lucifer, the Firebringer, you know, like the Promethean fire. It's typically associated with Polaris out of all the other stars.
Although that one slowly shifts, give it a few thousand years, we get a different North Star. Does Polaris maintain its you know, esoteric position, or does the new star become the new light bearer?
Completely depends on who you're talking to. Okay, which is what makes astrology such a fun and inexact science, right?
Yeah, that's the fun, and yeah, because you're melding astronomy and your astrology is kind of fun, just even as the, you know, a thought experiment, you know. So
yeah, and honestly, I think it's more stories. It's the same thing as, you know, Pinocchio. What is the morals that they tell you in Pinocchio? Everyone might walk away with a slightly different interpretation, which they found more important than the other. So there's a subjective quality to it, but then there's also an objective quality because there was an actual script. And you know, again, like we mentioned on these previous ones, when someone sits down and draws something over thousands and thousands of times for months of their life, it sort of takes away some of that spontaneity and like, oops, we accidentally, you know, snuck in this message. Like, now someone listened to that many, many times until they were sick of hearing it. So, you know, it wasn't like a lot of these things aren't coincidental.
Something that really stuck out, because in Snow White the dwarves were, the humans were rotoscoped, where the dwarves were not, but here it's like Geppetto is a, you know, has character animation, then the fairies rotoscoped, and I think she's the only character in this movie that is.
Yeah, and it's very easy to tell too. Like there's a distinct look, and I For people that might not have like an eye for looking at animation over and over, but one of the dead giveaways is that there's really no solid outline of her. It's almost like all color fills. And that was just because it's a little bit easier to sort of rotoscope with just a shifting shape, as opposed to a shape and the outline that goes with that shape. And that once you put that outline down, it almost starts to define shapes that might not look as natural as you do with the rotoscope. So if you're looking for it, you can almost tell. It's the same thing as like when you watch old cartoons, right? Like old Looney Tunes and old Disney cartoons. You could tell what was going to move and what was going to be in the foreground, because it always had like a slightly different color palette. It was usually a little bit more simplified and vibrant versus the background, which tended to be a little bit more textured. It was almost like a canvas painting in the background on that far plane, and then sort of like more primary and like basic colors in the foreground that they would move around in these like cell shading. So there's a little aspect of that too when you compare rotoscope to the other animation, because it's done in a completely different technique.
But yeah, the thing is, we have the more etheric character with the more realistic person behind it, and then Geppetto being a complete creation as the grounded character. So it almost seems like it should be the other way around. But again, the dwarves were the more magical creature, so they had the character animation in Snow White.
You know, in Snow White, it was actually the queen, I don't think, was not the queen, but you know, the evil stepmother. I don't think she had a whole lot of rotoscope. That was mostly the prince and Snow White.
Yeah. I guess we should break down what Geppetto's doing here, because he's making a wish. It's like he has
intention. He doesn't have a wife. He has no way to kind of procreate and pass on his knowledge. You know, he wants a buddy and he wants a son. He's a cat guy. He just has a cat at home and that's it. And a sexy fish.
Right. wouldn't this be the era of guilds? You'd end up with like an apprentice or something occasionally. You don't have to make your own, do you?
Yeah, but I mean, your apprentice is just going to move on. It's not like yours. It's just the intern that works there until they surpass you. And then, you know, they might come back and tell you how great you were, but chances are you won't see him again.
So does that make, if we are throwing a Gnostic overlay on it, does that make him a kind of demiurge, or is that like the blue fairy? How do you see that?
Well, I think the blue fairy is the actual divine essence. So the fairy is not the demiurge here. The fairy is that Promethean fire, that, you know, that light of Lucifer, that sort of human creative spark that gets invoked into the material world. Geppetto's the demiurge here because he's the one that's kind of full of flaws, and he's trying to take, you know, he's trying to like force this divine power into this flawed creation that he made that's probably got splinters and, you know, little mistakes here and there. Again, even when the blue fairy comes in representing this kind of divine spark, it affects Jiminy Cricket, which Jiminy Cricket is supposed to be Pinocchio's conscience. And the second this happens, he goes from hobo clothes to like a brand new three-piece suit, and he's got like a gold watch, and he's, you know, like he's completely transformed. And even those little highlights of gold, you could interpret to just say like, okay, yeah, he's been sort of touched by this divine spark, and all of that was profane to him is now sort of gilded.
Although I do find it mildly disturbing that you know, your conscience in this case is something that lives outside of you.
And that you can be separated from. It actually plays into this because he loses his conscience in a way that, you know, you would say someone kind of lost their morals.
Yeah. I mean, if a cricket is going to be as conscious, the I guess my thing would end up with like, you know, Star Trek II style earworms. So we don't want that.
That, and what's the lifespan of a cricket? I think it's not as long as a human, right? So
you're actually seeing a series of Jiminy crickets in this movie.
Okay. Yeah, they keep reproducing, and it's a new conscience each time.
Although to be fair, I wouldn't know he was a cricket if that wasn't, you know, in his name. So
I wanted to point out too, we were talking about Geppetto and who's the demiurge. Well, also the demiurge, for anyone that's not familiar, and I am not the Gnostic expert here, but I've read enough and I've had enough long conversations that I think I get like the broad strokes here. But essentially, the demiurge is like this god that sits in between the world that we're in, you know, Earth and the physical plane, the third and fourth dimension, the one that we're communicating in right now, right? So above us is sort of this demiurge that created this physical world. And above him are the actual gods that are truly ineffable and that are truly infallible. But we're not connected directly to these divine infallible gods. We have this middleman, this middle manager that kind of sucks at his job a little bit, kind of takes shortcuts maybe. And that explains why humans themselves are full of flaws and we take shortcuts. Like every one of our flaws is not necessarily, in a Gnostic sense of speaking, it's not this original sin from, you know, the Garden of Eden and Adam eating the apple that Eve gives him. It's more that the actual God that created us had flaws. Therefore, he passes flaws down to us. So that's this Gnostic aspect of it. And if you break down the word demiurge in Greek, sort of the etymology of it, it derives from this sense of being a maker or an artisan or a craftsman, which is exactly what Geppetto is in this story. He's an artisan. And like you mentioned before, he doesn't just limit it to violins and making music. He also makes clocks. He makes toys. He makes kind of tools that you see in the background. So he is truly like a master craftsman of all sorts of different things. Master with an asterisk there, because he pointed out that maybe he doesn't know how to make a correct violin. But I would say that reinforces this concept of a demiurge that can't help but create flawed items because he himself is flawed.
Yeah, one thing I've already kind of been picking up on the, in several Disney movies, both classic and closer to the present, is sort of the idea that characters in, well, Disney and Grimm or whatever, you know, they often do get a chance to meet their maker, and they get the chance to ask their maker anything to find out that their maker really doesn't know any answers. You know, Pinocchio's continual whys. It's like he's actually asking his creator, and we assume if that were to happen, they'd have the answers, but they never do.
Well, not if it's the demiurge, right? Because the demiurge is just a kid that got into his dad's toolbox, essentially. So he's not going to have any answers. He just knows that he stuck this thing over here and that thing turned on and something exploded. And oh God, I hope that wasn't too bad. That's essentially the demiurge, right? So it's hard getting answers out of him.
Now, one other kind of esoteric vibe, and this is just me spitballing again, but Jiminy also kind of being in the position of the sort of Akashic record, like he's kind of recording what happens with Pinocchio. It's almost like his job is to observe and to provide information when necessary.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost say that that's what your conscience is. Your conscience is this thing that's keeping a running tally of all your actions and reminding you of them later so that you can reflect on them and then apply your morality to your actions. And that's sort of what the conscience is. It's this running tally, this sort of like, you know, this little meter, this little litmus test that's letting you know, hey, am I acidic or am I base right now? And it helps you kind of keep in balance with it.
I also found it entertaining this time. Geppetto wakes up after snoring, like my wife accuses me of snoring, but he gets up, you know, and he's like, oh, someone's broken into the house. But the thing he's hearing was born in the house. You can't break into a house if you're born there.
Yeah, and he doesn't just wake up. They were making all sorts of calamity there, because Pinocchio was just for the first time kind of figuring out how to operate his human body. So he's completely out of sorts. And of course, he starts knocking over and destroying all the other demiurges' creations, you know, sort of like you could say humankind, as it sort of, you know, came onto the scene, starts destroying things and knocking things over to kind of make way for its evolution.
And let's not forget that Geppetto sleeps with a gun by his pillow.
Yeah, well, Winnie the Pooh had a gun too next to his bed, right? A lot of the old Disney characters had guns at a certain point, but that's for another episode. That might be an interesting one to kind of trace the use of firearms in Disney cartoons and like pinpoint the decline and the ramifications of it. That'll be an interesting.
100 Acre Woods was gangster, man. But I was watching like a Star Trek not too long ago where the guy's, you know, sleeping with a phaser under his pillow. It's a big deal, right? And I'm like, well, man, Geppetto, that's what he does every day, which is cool. We didn't break down Pinocchio's name yet, which I guess this is probably the best place to think about that.
Well, I wanted to point out too, because you mentioned before that all the different things in his shop, and he wasn't just a clockmaker. And I mentioned that in sort of a Gnostic sense, it makes a lot more logic. And that's because clocks represent the fourth dimension, which is time, which is kind of this boundary that sort of traps us in the physical realm. And again, as a Gnostic demiurge that kind of sits outside of our, you know, physical plane that controls us, he's in control of that fourth dimension, that time. So again, this is another reference to Geppetto literally being a demiurge, not just, you know, if you loosely look at it and bend over and, you know, close one eye and squint, it kind of looks like that. It's more like there's all of this building up examples of why he really is a demiurge in this story.
Now, just one thought, though, is in terms of Pinocchio, absolutely. And that's the name of the movie, so that's the main idea. And that, but we do have like an outside world outside of Geppetto's workshop, which he would not have created. Like, with the,
well, I guess we don't necessarily know that. In a highly, you know, sort of like metaphysical sense, he could, if he's the demiurge, that workshop could be the source of everything you see outside the workshop. You know, that could be like God, you know, Santa's workshop, and all the toys get sent out from there. But like the magic all starts in this one location. But this is reading far deeper into it than the movie itself explains. So
no, I was just going to go total 2022 and throw out the multiverse idea that Geppetto's workshop is like, you know, Pinocchio's universe, basically, right? So. Because if the blue fairy had not brought him to life, he probably may have never left the workshop unless he was purchased or something. And since Geppetto seemed to really make Pinocchio's kind of a personal thing, it didn't seem like it was something he was planning to sell.
Well, no, he was lonely and he wanted a buddy. And even before he wished that he was real, he was specifically saying like, oh, wouldn't it be great if that new toy that I just carved was like a real boy. And he's like saying it out loud before he even makes the wish. So just like the presence of this, you know, human figure, just that itself kind of like delighted him a little bit. And I keep going back to this demiurge thing, but it's also, you know, like God creating the form, like the Gnostic gods creating these forms of humans out of like the mud and the dirt and kind of like shaping them before they breathe life into them. It's kind of like that same thing. Like you're creating like a general vessel. And then once it looks similar to you, you identify with it. And then the divine spark comes.
Yeah.
In the shape of this blue fairy, essentially.
Or it could be the idea that everyone's perception is a slightly different universe. So from Pinocchio's perspective, for Pinocchio, he's the demiurge, but maybe the kid down the street, that's not the case.
Yeah, the kid down the street's got a different demiurge, I guess, in the realm of Pinocchio.
Right, find your own demiurge. Okay. the cat Figaro. I don't know. I was just actually listening to a podcast about Mozart, so I was like, oh, Figaro. Okay, there he is.
I really like the cat in this movie. I think the cat gets kind of a bum rap. It gets like kicked around by Pinocchio, and Geppetto steps on the cat. But the cat legitimately is like a nice cat. It doesn't do anything really mean. It even kisses the stupid fish.
I guess it is a school night here because they're staying up pretty late on a school night. So,
yeah.
But that is the first thought. Oh, you need to. You just came into creation. Now you need to go to school.
Well, it's more like you've just been, you know. You've just had this human divine consciousness put into you. Now you need to develop it or you're going to lose it entirely. That's essentially what the blue fairy tells the Pinocchio. It says, you know, you have to go out into the world and you have to be a good boy in order to become a real boy. So the implication there is that if he doesn't do this and he doesn't become a good boy, then perhaps he just stays forever this flawed being, or maybe even that divine spark leaves him again and he just goes back into like a dead, you know, pile of pieces of wood. It's never directly implied, but it feels like that's almost like an ominous ultimatum that she gives him. You know, it's like, do this or die.
Yeah. And of course, the first thing Pinocchio does on his own volition is light himself on fire. So, and he seems quite proud about it as well. So,
he's oblivious. Yeah, Geppetto is like running around with Pinocchio on fire. Pinocchio's got like a big smile on his face. he's just happy at like the commotion and just like everything that's going on, doesn't realize that, you know, I guess he would just violently die. I suppose he has no pain at that point. So if Geppetto didn't stick his finger into Cleo's water bowl to put his finger out, would he just kind of like silently sit there? Or would he start screaming at one point? I always wondered that.
Yeah, he feels no pain, I guess. He does have that like kind of exorcist spinning head thing. I notice there's an awful lot of, I mean, I guess that's because he's a puppet and you can do that. But yeah, later media has informed what's happening here. Is, you know, the almost lifeless weird grin of a spinning head is kind of creepy to the modern viewer.
I think it's pretty standard fare though for wooden marionettes.
Yeah, it's, I mean, obviously that's something you would do in that case. Now, once he does get out into the world, he meets foxes, which is weird because I think they're the only like anamorphic characters in this movie. Everything else is a human or an animal that cannot communicate.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you've also got the donkeys that they slowly turn into. So I guess like during that transition, they're like a hybrid anthropomorphic donkey that can talk, but then they slowly lose, like the worse they behave and the more they lose their morals and stray away from this education and losing this kind of like divine spark, then they lose their ability to talk as well.
Yeah, I guess literally the joke is they become an ass. I don't know if that works in Italian or not, but
it definitely works. The other part of it too was that the donkey kind of represented this aspect of like slave manual labor, and part of, I guess, kind of like the moral here, on like a very surface aspect of it, is that if you squander your education and you skip school, and instead of learning a trade and instead of learning a skill, then you're essentially just going to be relegated to manual labor for the rest of your life. And that people that got pushed into just manual labor because they had nothing else to fall back on were very easy to exploit. And that was that's kind of like the very superficial, easy to read version of all this, is that you skip school, you have to do a manual labor job, you get exploited for doing it. That's these donkeys that you turn into that just were essentially being used for manual labor.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Of course, his first job is performance, which seems more useful. I mean,
well, he wants to be an actor. That's I always thought that was funny too. That even the song that they are singing is all about like, oh, I'm going to go and be an actor, which, you know, ironically, and like now a kid wants to go into Hollywood and star in Disney movies, there's a good chance that it's not going to turn out so great, at least in a numbers game, you know, statistics speaking.
Yeah, I guess what is the carnival guy's name?
I think
name?
They're singing an actor's life for me. I think it's something like that.
I got no strings on me. Oh, and that might be there, but yeah, I got no strings on me is the,
well, that's the I've the got song. No strings to hold me down, which is probably my favorite song out of the entire movie.
yeah, that was still playing in my head this morning. So there's another earworm for us. Yeah, I guess I just think about the musical earworms and a little more than the sound effects ones, but I'm like, oh, the sound effects really take hold. That's kind of cool too.
I mean, I really feel, again, that it might seem so weird, but that's that stupid spanking clock with the kid yelping on beat. It's almost like it brings me to like the sampling of like the 80s and 90s, where you would take like a clip of something that wasn't supposed to be a percussive instrument and you turn it into a percussive instrument, and you pitch it and you turn it into a melody. You know what I mean? Like that kid getting spanked was like a 1940s, you know, Akai MPC sampler drum beat almost. It's so cool to hear.
Yeah, well, it was in the '80s because you paid so much money for the device that could do that. Whereas now you
that was like the SB 1200 or something, and it had like all 6 seconds of sampling time. Yeah, and it cost like over $1,000 at the time too.
Now sometimes I entertain students by sampling them and letting them play it on the virtual keyboard. So
that's awesome.
And just make them do something in English, makes it educational, right? But yeah, he does tech. I don't know. He you know, ends up with a new stage parent, I guess, a horrible stage parent. Like, if Stromboli, is that his name? Anyway, if he
Stromboli,
if
he was, and in the book, it's the coachman, and they're completely different depending on if you're reading the book or watching the movie. But the movie, it's Stromboli, which confused me because I don't think this was one of the scariest scenes in the movie for me, at least, was when he's actually in this carriage and they're driving it and it's all bumpy and there's like lightning outside and he's, you know, imprisoned here. That was so scary that every time I saw Stromboli on a menu at an Italian restaurant after that, I just completely ignored it, just thinking it was like something that I had wanted nothing part of. But then it turns out it's actually quite delightful.
Yeah, they serve you a hot mess of some kind. But like in that case, you know, Pinocchio had some bad luck. That could have been a workable situation, I suppose, if Stromboli had not been such a...
I don't know. I think I disagree, just because, again, the premise here was that he was given this divine spark of humanity and don't squander it. Mm-hmm. And part of that was like go to school. But the go to school was again, like, not literally go to school, even though he skipped school on like the first day. That's kind of where the whole plan goes awry. But it was like don't you know, just squander this divine spark of creation that you've been given. And it's the very first thing he does. So of course he ends up with Stromboli. He's willing to be exploited at the first person that'll let him. So that's exactly where he turns out. He meets the fox and his friend, and they sort of realize like, oh, we've got a unique little novelty here that could be, you know, almost like sent into the circus. And that's kind of where Stromboli gets them. And this is another interesting one too, is that I think that after we get to Pleasure Island, which I'm sure we'll get into in a second, but in the book, I believe he's going to be sold off to, like, the options are to be sold off to a manual labor where they're just like running around in a mill. One was a drum maker where they were going to skin Pinocchio and use his hide to make drums. And the other one was to go into a circus. So in the movie, it's like Stromboli putting Pinocchio directly into a circus before they get to Pleasure Island. But in the book, it's a little bit different. But it's interesting because they pick and, you know, choose like little threads here and there to include.
Yeah. Again, that's where I was thinking with the construction of the film. It's made where you could take out 5 to 8 minutes and kind of show it on its own, which I would just see as being a smart thing to do in the early 40s with your animated feature length.
This will be the absolutely most terrifying scene to extract and show someone without context.
Yeah, that could
here's the scene of like a strange old man just kidnapping a child, and that's it. It just starts and ends with, you know, this guy kidnapping.
And then Pinocchio's lies create life. I never caught on that before. You know, it's, his nose grows when he lies to the blue fairy, of course. But then birds come out of his nose and fly away. So again, now Pinocchio is a demiurge to those birds.
Yeah, I mean the lies quite literally start taking on a life of their own, and he can't control it. And he tries pushing it back in. You know, he's like trying to get his nose back into his face, which is, you know, futile. Because, you know, the lies are out there.
But yeah, who knows? Maybe that's a metaphor that comes across as pretty sharp. this was weird. When they cut back to Geppetto's workshop and it's showing him, like, oh, I got to go search for him in the animals. Did you notice how he feeds his fish?
No, point it out to me.
Okay, he had taken a piece of chocolate cake, tied a red ribbon around it, and dropped it into the fish tank. It's like, that's fantastic.
That's how they used to feed fish in the 40s.
Yeah, and of course the cat had that ridiculous well, he was eating fish. Yeah, he was getting a much larger fish, so good for the cat, I guess. But
that would make me a little nervous. Yeah, you see someone eating the bigger version, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be terrifying if you saw someone over yonder eating a human while you're trying to have your chocolate cake. Let's see. I guess we should move on and start making our way towards Pleasure Island. That is what sticks in people's head the most from this movie, I guess. I don't know. There are so many things that could. You can think of the whale too. So, but Pleasure Island is that. That's one where okay, you could just have like a Pleasure Island cartoon. Still very disturbing, of course. But
yeah, and in the book it was the Land of Toys, and they specify in the original book that the Land of Toys is in this kind of fictional region that more or less translates to Cockney, which is also interesting because unrelated semantically to Cockney, the Stromboli character actually speaks in a Cockney slang, which is the same name as the sort of utopian world that they came from in the book. And to put a hat on top of a hat here, Cockney meaning like a cock's egg, which is something impossible that can't exist. And in like medieval alchemy, the creature that would come from a cock's egg was a basilisk, and a basilisk represented, depending on how you look at it, like in alchemy, there's like this chemical version of it where it's an actual chemical formula that was kind of telling people how to transmute metals and the properties of, you know, different substances. And then there's the alchemical sort of like metaphorical version, which is talking about, again, like the human divine spirit and how to purify it. And a basilisk in both of those instances, both in the chemical and in this metaphorical alchemical sense, represents purification by fire or trial by fire or going through hell and coming out the other end, sort of like through atonement. So you could almost make this direct correlation of Cockney in the book is this utopia, this Pleasure Island. It's literally in Cockney, and Stromboli being this Cockney guy bringing Pinocchio there. So I always found that was so interesting because Pleasure Island is essentially hell. If this were the Bible, if Pinocchio were the Bible, this is like the Book of Revelations essentially, is when they go to Pleasure Island and all turn into donkeys and it's just horrible everywhere. And this is his trial by fire. This is what purifies him and turns him back into a good boy and lets him restore his morality again.
Now, in the movie, it seems they stay on the island for about one night. I feel like he was there longer in the book, if I'm correct.
They condense it a little bit, but there's one similar aspect that regardless of the full passage of time is that the worse you are as a kid, the quicker you turn into one of these asses. So the friend that Pinocchio was with, he turns into an ass almost immediately because he's essentially the worst kid on all of Pleasure Island, or in the book, the worst kid in the Land of Toys. So it's almost like the second he steps foot on the island, it's like, bam, he's an ass. For Pinocchio, it takes him a little bit longer. He has to make a whole bunch of like a series of bad decisions. And each time he makes a bad decision, he turns a little bit more into an ass more and more, until he eventually, almost becomes complete ass. So it kind of just shows though that like Pinocchio is being afforded multiple mistakes that he keeps screwing up. But you could again argue though that like he has to make these mistakes. Like he has to go through hell in order to be purified and come back out a real boy.
Well, until he's a real boy, he does maintain his donkey parts. So they don't go away when you leave the island.
So, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention, because this part is probably my favorite sort of like Gnostic, like secret hidden meaning aspect of it, because there's a book called The Metamorphoses of the Golden Ass. And it's a much older book than Pinocchio was. And it was almost certainly one of the inspirations for this Pleasure Island or the Land of Toys, because even the Land of Toys, they both turn into an ass. That's one of the consistent themes between the book and the movie. But in the Metamorphosis of the Golden Ass, there is a person that gets tempted by the wonders of magic, and it's this foolishness of being enticed by like magical thinking. Again, it goes to this morality of, you've been given this divine spark, are you going to harness it and try to educate yourself and, you know, evolve? Or are you going to just elapse immediately into magical thinking, which is almost like the complete departure of trying to educate yourself? It's just, you know, let Jesus take the wheel. That's kind of like the magical thinking aspect of this here. So in the book of The Metamorphosis of the Golden Ass, once someone kind of embraces this wonder of magic, it leads them to join like a mystery cult. And then in part of this, they become an ass. And the golden ass is literally that. It's like to show like what an ass this person is.
I am thinking of a book I read a few years ago about one of the long-lived, you know, Indian guru types who, you know, he never... As apparently at some point someone asked him, did you read the Bhagavad Gita? And he's like, I don't need to. It's written in the universe. Just as an interesting thought of
touche, I guess. Touche a little bit.
just like he's obviously like full on magical thinking, yeah. Right?
So, I've got a library card to the Akashic Records, so I don't need to check anything out. I'm just always there.
That's kind of what he was saying. Yeah. Now, if
you know, I understand it. I mean, I talk to a lot of people that strongly believe in the magical thinking. I guess my take on that is magical thinking to me personally, in my, you know, somewhat limited worldview, but magical thinking is almost like if I fall asleep with my math on this headbook through osmosis, you know, the formulas will just seep into my brain and then I'll understand it all. It's like, no, you actually have to like with intent and focus, you know, digest the material over and over and practically apply it and, you know, see if it works for yourself. But that's not everyone's worldview.
No, I've always got 5 books open on my iPod at any given moment. So I'm certainly not going against reading. I just thought it was an interesting kind of polar opposite to that idea. So. And learning to experience, I guess that's what I was getting at earlier with, I was like, well, I don't know if Stromboli wasn't such a villain, you know, maybe Pinocchio could learn from these experiences, traveling around, you know, the school of life, man. Now, again, this is the morality play. So obviously he was in the wrong place. So I was just thinking, well, from a realistic perspective, you could learn this way too.
Yeah. I mean, but I think there's like the movie kind of proves, but one of the points that I take away from it that they don't overtly state it, but if Pinocchio had just gone to school that day and just done exactly what he was told, I'm not convinced that he necessarily would just like magically become a real boy either. You know, it's like, this is a little bit of a stretch here, but I guess it's almost like the story of Jesus, right? Like if Jesus knew that he was going to get crucified and he ends up like running away or avoiding it somehow, then he doesn't die for the sins of the world. And therefore, you know, original sin doesn't get washed away. And therefore Christianity and the whole point of Christianity doesn't exist. So it's like he had to get crucified in order for sins to be washed in that mythology. So in this mythology of Pinocchio, Pinocchio has to go to Pleasure Island. He has to get kidnapped by Stromboli. He has to be purified by that fire of the basilisk in order to become a real boy. He never could have done it by just going to school and doing his homework and going home. It just never would have transformed him because he needed to go through a truly alchemical transformation, not just a regular ho-hum, you know, do what's expected.
Yeah. So, you know, if he had just gone to school for a few weeks, the blue fairy would have shown up and okay, I guess I'll turn you into a robot.
You're good to go. Yeah. It's like giving the allowance, right? Like he just slowly becomes a real boy over time instead of becoming a donkey and then immediately getting transformed. But interestingly enough, it's like she comes and it's like, even though he's part jackass for doing all this dumb stuff and never actually goes to school a day in his life, despite that being what he needed to do. But like you said, you know, he kind of went through the school of life. He didn't go to the school down the street, and that might have even been what the fairy was getting at. It's certainly what the movie gets at.
That's the other thing that caught me with the fairy being okay, this is the last time I can possibly help you. I'm like, I don't know, he's kind of your responsibility. You made him. Well, you gave him life, I should say. Geppetto made him. She gave him life.
I think she was just saying what he needed to hear. It's one of those aspects.
Yeah, I'm just saying, don't shirk your responsibilities, fairy. You made the mess. Well, you made the possibility of the mess. So,
and I've got a random tangent here too, that the actress for the Blue Fairy here, she was also, among others, there was like four different models, but she was one of the main models for Columbia, the Columbia Pictures logo, which existed from 1936 through 1970 or something. So if you've seen that Columbia, movie intro before any kind of old movie, that was the same exact lady, or one of the four ladies that posed, was this Blue Fairy. Like she was fairly popular for being sort of like a rotoscoped model in a lot of different aspects.
Now it's like, now you have the major voice work actors, right? So,
yep. And when she retired, she basically became obsessed with classical Greek plays and became like a Greek drama teacher. So again, it just ties back into like the people that were involved in this movie. They couldn't have read the script and watched it and not seen some of these, you know, like Greek mythological archetypes and these Gnostic sort of teachings. Like it is just so heavy, and the people that were involved were so deep into this that it's impossible that it just went completely over their heads.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're doing this, because a fan of Disney is going to be like, good animation, still entertaining, but maybe not missing all the, because, you know, it's cool stuff baked in. It's interesting stuff. It makes the movie way deeper, right?
Yeah, and it's such a like a timeless story. You could almost do like a Joseph Campbell style Hero of a Thousand Faces, hero's journey. Not beat for beat here, but just the concept of an inanimate, flawed human that needs some kind of external assistance. This is almost like the wise old mentor, or the one that bestows some mythological gift that has supernatural powers they give the protagonist. It's just the same archetype. It just happens to be the Blue Fairy instead of the wise old man in this story. But they follow like these same beats, and those archetypes exist for a reason. It's because they're very motivational, and they tap into something in our lizard brains that's like, hey, you've been here before. And it's like, you know, like an ancient memory that you've got.
One other thing that hit me on Pleasure Island is just visually where we're coming from, because, you know, in 15 years, Disney's kind of going to try and make its own Pleasure Island, right? With no alcohol served at it, but, you know.
So they already had one, right? Like, you were familiar with the Pleasure Island that was in Orlando for a while?
Yeah, I think I may know about that. Yeah. And also I was thinking, like, visually, like Luna Park, something like that. You know, I have the Coney Island places were kind of known for being, places to go have some pleasure, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting, the change of the Land of Toys to Pleasure Island in the name of this Disney movie. Again, I don't know. I don't know if the connotation of Pleasure Island in 1940 has the same imagery that gets conjured up in 2022, but Pleasure Island definitely takes a much more adult sort of ambiance when you mention it versus what happens in the movie.
Yeah, because
what happens in the movie was like I assume every like 12-year-old boy's fantasy in 1940, which was to play pool and smoke cigars and not have any adults around. That was like the pinnacle of utopia for a 12-year-old, I guess, in the 40s.
Yeah, 8-ball bar looked like a fun place to hang out. Sure, why not?
It honestly looked very similar to most of the pool halls that I saw in the military.
I was put some pinball machines. I was reading it. Apparently in the 30s, pinball machines were considered extremely decadent and, you know, things you should stay away from those pinball halls as well. So to the point where New York City apparently had like anti-pinball laws all the way into like the 80s or something. It was crazy.
Yeah. Well, that was this is a fun tangent just because I'm obsessed with sort of pinball history too, but part of that is because they saw it as a gambling machine, because for the longest time, it was almost like written in legal code somewhere that pinball didn't operate on skill. It operated purely on chance. And the fact that you could put a quarter in and, you know, either like get extended play or get these points that could potentially be redeemed for something else, that there was no skill involved. It was all just happening per chance and just like random, you know, number generation. They made it illegal, but it actually took someone to play it well enough to prove that it was actually a skill-based game that overturned this idea of looking at pinball machines as lottery machines and gambling machines as opposed to an arcade machine, which might also be part of the premise of Tommy the Pinball Wizard. But I believe it's actually rooted in, you know, fact, and that's why they were banned and then unbanned later on.
Yeah. In Japan, we have a pachinko machines, which truly is not a game of skill. The balls just drop. Gambling is not legal. So the weird solution is people get their balls and then they can trade their balls at a different store next door for, you know, stuff.
Yeah. So they didn't gamble there. They gambled somewhere else. But the place where they redeem it doesn't know if they gamble or not to get those balls. Therefore, they're not, you know, assisting the gambling process. Yeah, it's I guess every country has their own workarounds and red tape, right?
Yeah, exactly. But if you ever step into one of those places, it'll instantly drive you insane.
I was lucky enough that I had some neighbor, or my grandparents had these neighbors in upstate New York that had pachinko machines in their basement, because I guess one of the guys had gone to Japan and part of like a military tour and fell in love with pachinko machines and bought like two or three and brought them back. And I remember just going down in the basement while all the adults were upstairs doing boring stuff, just playing pool and smoking cigars and playing pachinko machines.
Did you get a donkey tail?
Yeah, I've still got it to this day.
We definitely need to move on to our giant fish. I can't call it a fish. It's a whale. I used to teach at the whale camp. We made it clear that whales are not fish there.
Well, in the book, it is a fish. And I forgot what type of fish. I wish I could remember. I might have to look it up. But in the book, it is specifically a type of fish that has fish in the name. But yeah, in the movie, it's a whale. I don't think it really matters between the two if it's a fish or a whale, because they both kind of represent the same story. The biblical story would be Jonah and the whale, but Jonah and the whale itself, it's based on older pagan stories, just like every single story in the Bible is. But this is such another interesting aspect of it, because for example, whale versus fish, right? In the Sistine Chapel, Jonah next to him on the Sistine Chapel, it's actually a fish. It's not a whale. It is very clearly a fish next to him. Now, I don't know if that's because, you know, when it was originally painted, they just didn't care a whole lot about big fish versus whale. It might have been kind of, you know, potato tomato sort of situation.
Maybe, you know, these things have become whales more recently because we're not really willing to accept a fish that big. I mean, there could be way deep in the ocean, I don't know, but the idea of a fish that big seems kind of like ridiculous, whereas a whale that size seems perfectly reasonable.
Well, I think a fish the size of a whale was sort of referred to as like a leviathan. It was this like monstrous sea creature that, you know, like almost a mythological creature, because I imagine that if you had never seen like a video of a whale and your whole life, the biggest animal, you know, if you didn't go to a zoo, right, what's the biggest animal you think you would see in normal life, in your normal life from when you were born? Because you got to get rid of what, elephants and rhinos and whales, and like you wouldn't have seen a giraffe unless you went to Africa. So what do you think the largest animal you ever would have seen in real life would be?
From where I'm sitting right now, bears.
A bear, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, well, not.
How much size, bigger than a bear is a freaking whale, man? I mean, I could just imagine someone, you know, coming back from sea and describing the sheer size of like a whale that they might have seen and be like, yeah, you know, I get it. You're kind of like pumping up your stories to make it sound more impressive than it is. But truly, I mean, these things were, they must have looked like monsters. So again, like whale, huge fish, who the hell really cares? It was like a huge monster thing out under the water that you couldn't see.
Right. Now, Pinocchio has some superpowers, though, because as he's, you know, Geppetto, of course, is trapped in the whale, Jonah style or whatever. And Pinocchio doesn't have to breathe because he's a puppet. Why does he want to be a real boy? He's like an X-Man right now.
That's a good point, man. You can't, like, a piece of wood can't drown. Maybe you can get, you know, what, waterlogged or something, pun intended. But yeah, if he were a real boy at this point, he never would have been able to save Geppetto, his dad, and Geppetto would have died.
Yeah, exactly. So I wonder if the ending of this movie should be Pinocchio accepting himself as what he is. I don't know.
I mean, if you wanted to go beat for beat and keep playing this through like a mythological archetype, then essentially Geppetto would have gotten out of the fish on his own after 3 days and nights, which is a very mystical repeating number here. You know, Jesus in the cave, 3 days, 3 nights, but he goes into the whale for 3 days and 3 nights, and he essentially would have just prayed back to the same North Star, Polaris, Lucifer, Prometheus, whoever you want to call it, that would have come down. And just like in the book of Jonah, God essentially forces the whale to vomit and, you know, spit Jonah back up. In the movie, he doesn't vomit. He just kind of gets like sent back out through the blowhole. So it's a little bit less, but I guess, you know, a whale vomiting is actually a pretty normal aspect of its routine. It's not like going to the bar and passing out and like throwing up chunks, you know, like that's actually part of just the whale, pushing the water back out through its teeth, essentially.
Right. I caught a cold from a whale once. That was weird. I mean, they are, like, you know, closely related. Doing the whale camp, I'm on a boat. I'm a teacher. The whale comes, and of course, when it blows, it's basically like blowing snot at you, right? So I got covered in whale snot and had a cold the next day. So I'm assuming that.
That's interesting. I don't know if I've ever met someone that caught a cold from a whale. That's
that's my claim to fame. My father's claim to fame is getting crapped on by seagulls on the east and west coast in the same month.
You know, I've got this short list of easily achievable moments in human history. Like, for example, if you're the first person in space, you can be the first person to do a whole list of very mundane things, but be the first person ever, right? So like the first person to, this is probably taken, but like the first person to stub their toe in space, that one's easy. The mm-hmm. first person to get mugged in space, the first person to mug someone else in space. Like there's all sorts of very easy things, but man, you could just go out in space and just be the first one to do so many freaking things.
It's like the George Carlin bit where he's like, I'm going to say sentences that no one's ever made before.
Yeah, exactly.
So, man, they shouldn't let you into the space program. You'll be mugging the other
astronauts. I'll take over all of it. Yeah, the whole Guinness Book of Space Records will just be me on, like, the first 100 pages. Like, this guy got all the low-hanging fruit. It's not even fair. The first person to say their name, the first person to recite the alphabet. Like, come on, these aren't even real things.
We've got about 15 minutes, so I just want to make sure we're not missing any major topics you want to hit on this one.
Let's see. Oh, so this is one. This is less about the movie itself, but there's this funny anecdote about the movie premiere. And I don't know if you looked at my notes and saw this, or if you've heard this story before about the Pinocchio premiere in Rockefeller Center in New York City.
excuse me. No. Keep going. I'm not drawing a hit on that one.
Okay, so when the movie first was released, it was this big to-do. You know, again, this was immediately following Snow White. This is on the trail of this huge kind of like blockbuster, first time that it's ever come out full-length color motion movie. And they really wanted to follow this up with a big bang and keep the promotion going to establish Disney as, you know, the cartoon company of the world, essentially. And in part of this, to hype everyone up, they went out and they created a whole bunch of Pinocchio costumes that were essentially, like, if you look at Geppetto in the movie and Pinocchio standing next to him, Pinocchio is the size of like a small toddler, you know, like a tiny child, essentially, comes up to maybe Geppetto's waist, not even. So Disney had this really smart idea to create these little Pinocchio costumes and find little people. Adult little people that would put these Pinocchio costumes on and essentially just go and interact with families and children that were waiting in line to go and see this movie at the premiere. So he does this, but it's a really, really hot day out. And these little people aren't necessarily like trained actors or anything. They literally just went out and found anyone that would kind of like fit the height requirement to get into these suits. And then in order to keep them entertained, because I don't think they were paid a whole lot, they essentially just gave them like a big spread, like a craft services table. They just had, you know, sandwich meat and just all kinds of stuff on it. And then what apparently was like an endless supply of alcohol. So what happens is that at the beginning of the night in the premiere, it's fine. You know, they're going, they're interacting. But as the hours kind of pass by, they're getting drunker and drunker. And, you know, essentially what I can only imagine, because the amount of information on this is very sparse. There's photos of the event and there's newspaper reports after it happens. So we can be somewhat certain that this event actually did happen, but all of like the fine details are a little bit hazy. But essentially, the little people end up getting drunk because they were supplied with normal people amounts of alcohol. No one, you know, thought like, oh, we can just give them like a quarter, you know, like a third of what we would normally put out. So they're getting absolutely hammered. And this compared with being under the hot sun all day, you know, they start kind of becoming delirious and the alcohol hits them a lot harder than it normally would. And they began like chastising people waiting in line and almost like heckling the audience members, to the point where Disney was like, okay, this is actually going exactly opposite from how we wanted. We wanted like these friendly mascots to like entice people and, oh, I met the real Pinocchio. And instead you're going to see this movie premiere and this little dude up, you know, on the top of the building is like spitting at you and cursing and throwing food at you and using all sorts of vulgarities. So like parents are covering their children's ears, and this keeps escalating, right? Like it doesn't just like kind of die down on its own. It keeps escalating and it gets so bad that the police are called, and the police go up on top of where this little platform where all of these little Pinocchios are staying. And since it had gotten so hot, a lot of them just began stripping their clothes off, and they didn't have any clothes on underneath the Pinocchio outfits. So the police go up on top of this little platform. They see a whole bunch of naked little people, some dressed as Pinocchio, some half dressed as Pinocchio, some totally nude. And they're literally smoking cigars, they're playing cards, and they've got alcohol. Like it's literally Pleasure Island, you know, on this little platform above. So the police, they start chasing them around, and it actually makes way for like a comical, like Benny Hill style chase scene where, like, you know, these little people scatter in different directions and a couple cops are trying to chase them down. And the whole culmination, right, the climax of this whole event that absolutely happened was the police putting these little people in burlap sacks and bringing them down a ladder and throwing them essentially into a paddy wagon in little burlap sacks. So, I mean, I don't know if this were on video, this would probably be way better of an entertaining video to watch than the Pinocchio movie. And that might be sacrilege to say, but man, I just wish that I could have been a fly on the wall when this was all happening. And I can only imagine too, you know, Disney and all the executives like freaking out about how horribly awry this whole sort of publicity attempt went.
They should have been just like, go get some donkey tails, stat, just throw them on the little people.
this is a moral thing. Yeah, we're trying to teach a lesson.
Well, I know the Disney mascot costumes and such were quite disturbing, probably until when did they start looking like reasonable? I just know when you see the 50s mask, like Mickey Mouse costumes and stuff, they're like mildly terrifying looking.
Yeah, I mean, I think in like the 70s or 80s, they did the thing where they would start making like the huge eyes, and it was like a mesh. So now they like everything happened through the eyes. But before then, the masks would like almost make just like a little hole where the mouth was. And like, they almost pretended like it was an actual head on top of your head. But, it, you know, obviously like the airflow and the acoustics and just the whole practical aspect of it didn't work out. So hence these people all, you know, stripping down and taking the masks off and taking, you know, their costumes off and running around naked to cool down. Like, I don't know if you've ever been to New York City or in major, almost any major city, but like that asphalt is just soaking up the sun all day. So even after the sun goes down, now all of that heat starts dissipating from, you know, the concrete and the asphalt, and it gets really hot.
Yeah, the urban heat island.
Yep.
So But yeah,
that's one of my favorite stories, and a lot of people have never even heard that before. It's fun to look into. And if you look hard enough, you can find an actual image, and it's from the Disney History Institute or Historical Institute or something. And it's got like four or five of these little Pinocchios, you know, waving down at the crowd. This is presumably probably like 3 or 4 hours before it just went haywire.
Okay, that is a way to definitely cap off your not very caught, I guess, but I don't know, it's a bacchanal. There we go. Grecian style bacchanal. So the premiere was New York City. I was sitting there thinking, couldn't you just go hire the folks that were in The Wizard of Oz? But maybe they were West Coasters. So
yeah, and this was also sort of like a last minute thing, I think. Like, it was clearly not planned out enough in advance that where they were like vetting the people that they were hiring. It must have just happened like a couple weeks before that premiere.
Yeah, I'm going to guess someone got fired the next day.
Someone thought it was a great idea and then immediately regretted it. Guaranteed, yeah.
Yeah. I guess we'll wind down today then. Could you, giving you an option here to throw out something else with the audit?
Not really. The other cool thing that we didn't really get into, which is a tiny note, but if you break down the actual word Pinocchio, Pin being pine, assuming that he came from a pine tree, but this could also be a reference to like the pineal gland, again, because it's invoking this divine consciousness into this inanimate creature. And essentially there's, you know, the Gnostic and sort of mystical visions of this is that the pineal gland is the seat of the soul. So if there were some kind of divine spark coming from without, it would necessarily go through your pineal gland, at least according to sort of this sort of realm of information. And that Occhio stands for eye. So you've got this pine fruit eye. So it's almost a direct reference to pineal gland. It's likely not what he had in mind when he came up with Pinocchio, Pino being a diminutive of Giuseppe, as we mentioned before, because it was Giuseppino. So they took Pino, Occhio, Pinocchio. I love like kind of the wordplay because it can mean so many different things, but it could also just be a bunch of like semantic coincidences. It's really hard to know unless you go back and talk to the original authors, but that's one of my favorite things, just the wordplay on the word Pinocchio itself.
Yeah, they actually do specifically mention him being made of pine, because I made a note here being like, why not mahogany or spruce? So
those were a little bit classier than Pinocchio.
Yeah. Well, you build the instruments of spruce, I guess. So, but hey, you can build guitars out of pine too.
I bet you if you look hard enough, there's probably like a really cool, like esoteric reference to pine wood versus other types of wood that he could have been carved out of.
Yeah. Because I mean, back to your pineal gland, that's like the pine shaped like pine cone, right? So there's even a connection there.
Yeah, correct. Well, that's exactly why it's called the pineal gland, is because the shape represents this pine cone. And again, Pino, even without it being the like a nickname for Giuseppino, is that Pino literally translates to pine and Occhio translates to eye. So Pinocchio directly translates to pine eye, pineal gland. It's because the pineal gland too, for anyone that's not aware, it's almost like a dead eye socket. Like, it has the same sort of wiring and optical nerve endings that your actual eyes do, but it's almost like something lost to evolution long ago, where, you know, you don't actually have an eye in there, but it essentially takes the same anatomy of an eye. So it's almost like if we all had a third eye at some point, but it just kind of shriveled up and died. And now it's just this empty hole where this third eye could come back into being again. And again, this is not a new age 1980s, 1990s retrospect back in. The concept of the pineal gland being at the heart of the soul goes all the way back to like the 1700s, perhaps even earlier than that. So this is definitely something that, you know, the wordplay probably was not lost on the original authors or on the animators that adapted it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Tibetan imagery, it's been going, that's been there for thousands of years, right?
Yeah, I think Rene Descartes is one of the ones attributed to calling it the like the seat of the soul, at least in sort of modern Western philosophy.
This has absolutely no interpretive value whatever, but Pino in Japan is a delicious ice cream treat.
It's also a wine, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's true.
That's with a T, but whatever.
Well, wrapping up today, could you give folks where to find you and all of your work?
Oh, yeah, that's right. So, yeah, you can find me in my comic books at paranoidamerican.com. And then if you want to see what I'm working on, like, up to date, you can go to my Instagram, which is at paranoidamerican. And actually, just this week, I think I've announced, like, 4 or 5 brand new projects. So, yeah, go follow me on Instagram if you want to see all the new stuff.
Groovy. As for this one, it is Oral Hygiene. We're on Facebook, Twitter, all of that. We make lots of podcasts out here in Japan with our pals. It's under the Patreon umbrella of Podcastio Podcastius. You can hear about science fiction films, The Twilight Zone, Pokemon, and the somewhat aggressive game show, where you can hear some Brits screaming obscenities at each other about obscure video games. It's fun.
It's almost like Call of Duty, but just a little bit more dignified, right?
Yeah, that sounds right. Well, actually, they have like, you know, one guy's more into that kind of game. They got the fighting guy kind of, you know, fighting game sort of guy. So they come from slightly different spheres of the gaming world. But I'm not that much of a gamer myself, so I don't know. But
oh, you're right in the heartland, though, man. This like Japan is like a video game mecca for a lot of the people that I know.
Oh yeah, we still have some arcades. I've been to some very good arcades, so I'm not saying I have weirdly specific knowledge about like JRPGs that were on the DS. So I'm not bereft of these skills, but or knowledge or whatever. But yeah, got to go to Pleasure Island to find the best arcade. So off we go. Okay, so I was leaving a bit of silence, and I'm going to start my walk to the train. It's a good way to get exercise, but basically like the train I need to get to work doesn't stop at the station I live at, so I have to take like an hour walk. Well, I mean, there are other options, but you know, it's a good way to get some exercise and stuff. I actually retweaked the schedule a little bit to start getting these out, so I already have a few posted. Sorry, I'm bringing up my podcast schedule thing here. I think I have Fantasia actually coming out this Friday. I moved it up a bit. Excuse me. June 4th is going to be Fantasia. June 18th will be Snow White, which means I guess it'll be July 2nd for the one we're doing today. So yeah, I'll start sending you links and stuff this Friday. So, and we'll have that for people's ears. But for now, yeah, the point is there's I do want to at least cap off Dumbo and get the pre-war Disney stuff under the belt, but there is quite, you know, at your leisure, right? Because we got a month.
Okay, yeah, right on, man. I'm ready for whatever. Although whatever we do next, I'm actually gonna have to watch the movies a few times because this is pretty much what I watched up to was Pinocchio. And like I was mentioning before, Dumbo is going to be rough just because it's like that one's going to pull on my heartstrings quite a bit.
But yeah, if I can get you on that one, you know, we could do that one like 2 or 3 weeks, you know, which gives plenty of time for both of us to delve on the movie. And fortunately, it's only 60 minutes long, so it doesn't. No, I think it's like 60, somewhere around 60 minutes long. It's really short, so it's not hard to actually watch that one a few times. Pinocchio is actually a little longer than I thought. For some reason, I thought that was 60 minutes, and it's actually proper movie length. So good for it.
A lot of work, man. A lot of work. No one was Photoshop, you know, copying frames on that one.
Yeah, really. Okay, I will catch you later. I'm going to stop recording here.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.